I would always think, is this a place that is reasonably safe for me? I definitely feel that has changed, that there's far less that is truly safe.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, we're talking so-called bathroom bills, their effects, their baseless legislative rationales, and their shaky legal standing. Of all the recent religious freedom legislation passed around the country, perhaps none is so restrictive as North Carolina's An Act to Provide for Single-Sex Multiple Occupancy Bathroom and Changing Facilities in Schools and Public Agencies and to Create Statewide Consistency in Regulation of Employment and Public Accommodations. The short version of the bill's name is the Public Facilities Privacy and Security Act, but it quickly became infamous as HB2. Passed as a response to a non-discrimination ordinance enacted by the City of Charlotte, HB2 removed the protections under that law and others like it, attempted to redefine sex under the law, and barred transgender people from using restrooms on state property that conformed to their gender. The legal and economic consequences to North Carolina were swift, but so far neither the legislature nor the governor shows any willingness to overturn the bill. On this week's show, Jen Wilson and Peggy Knutson talk to Chris Brook, legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union of North Carolina, about the ACLU's suit against the state. Peggy Knutson and Stephanie Zavan also speak with Danielle White, a transgender activist engaging in civil disobedience against HB2.
And welcome to the Humanist Hour. I am Peggy Knutson.
And I'm Jen Wilson.
We are here today interviewing Chris Brook. Chris is a legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union of North Carolina, where he oversees the organization's legal program and its work on a wide range of constitutional law issues, including LGBT rights, racial justice, and religious liberty. He is a native of North Carolina and a member of the North Carolina Advocates for Justice Racial Justice Task Force. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So today we're having you on the show to talk a little bit about what has been happening recently in North Carolina with the Public Facilities Privacy and Security Act. Can you give us a little bit of background on that and the timeline on that bill, also known as HB2?
Certainly. Well, the largest city in North Carolina is Charlotte, which is the 17th largest city in the nation. And Charlotte, over 2015 and into 2016, debated putting in place a local non-discrimination ordinance. And that local non-discrimination ordinance would be inclusive of the LGBT community. They considered it once and voted it down. Some of the members who voted against did not want to extend any protections to the LGBT community. Others objected to the fact that at that point there had not been protections extended to the transgender community. There was an election in Charlotte in 2015. Some new people came on to the city council. And they reconsidered it at that point and passed it 7-4. You know, even before Charlotte took the vote, the governor of our state, Pat McCrory, warned that that would result in legislative action. Before the ordinance went into effect, it was supposed to go into effect on April 1st of 2016. The legislature came back for really an unprecedented emergency session on March 23rd, and in less than 12 hours, introduced and passed HB2, which, you know, has been dubbed by some the bathroom bill, but it, you know, and part of it is requiring individuals to use the restroom that complies with what is listed in the gender marker on their birth certificate. But there are other provisions as well. It prohibited localities from protecting the LGBT community from discrimination in public accommodations like restaurants and hotels. It prevented localities from protecting the LGBT community in the employment context, such that LGBT employees could be fired by someone who was contracting with the city or county just because they were gay. And then there were a number of provisions that made it harder to sue for discrimination in state courts. And all of this was signed into law by Governor McCrory the same day of the legislative session. So less than 12 hours after it was introduced, HB2 became the law of North Carolina.
That seems highly unusual how that played out so quickly.
Yeah, no, I mean, they had not had a special session that was called by the legislature, as this one was called, for nearly 35 years. I don't know that we've ever had a special session that has dealt with a civil rights issue before. And certainly, you know, at one point, the first committee that got this bill in our state house, they sort of laid the text of the bill out on the table and said, you have 5 minutes to read it. So regardless of your ideological persuasion, this was very atypical legislating and not a way that you would want to conduct a deliberative process to produce good legislation.
My understanding is in this bill, the definition of sex was changed. Are you able to explain that?
Sure. So most statutes, including Title IX and Title VII, Title IX, which is a federal statute governing the use of federal educational funds, Title VII, which prohibits discrimination in the workplace, just prohibit sex discrimination. And sex discrimination has been interpreted over the years by the courts, as well as by the Department of Education, as well as the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, to include gender identity. To get around that interpretation, the legislature with HB2 did not speak of sex. They spoke of biological sex. And then they defined biological sex as meaning what was listed on your birth certificate in the gender marker spot. That is problematic for a number of different reasons for the transgender community. First, there are a number of states where you can't ever change the gender marker on your birth certificate. So, for example, if you were born in Tennessee, and then which is an adjacent state here to North Carolina, then lived in North Carolina, you can't ever change your gender marker if you were born in Tennessee. So you could be exactly similarly situated to a transgender person in North Carolina and not be able to access the appropriate bathroom just because of where you had been born in Tennessee. But even in North Carolina, where it is possible to change the gender marker on your birth certificate, it's an exceptionally onerous process with surgical requirements that are entirely inaccessible to minors under the age of 18 who simply cannot undergo gender confirmation surgery. And then there's obviously such surgery is quite expensive, so there's an economic barrier that exists there as well. And then there are a number of instances where for transgender individuals, surgical intervention is simply not medically indicated or appropriate. So the definition of biological sex that was offered by the legislature with HB2 and signed off on by our governor very clearly is targeting the transgender community and making it much more difficult for them to use the restroom that comports with their gender identity and is the appropriate restroom for them to utilize.
Can you tell us a little bit about the response that has occurred? I believe the North Carolina Attorney General will not defend this law, and they did have to amend it a little bit to protect government and state workers. What has the overall response been?
Well, the response has been a real public backlash. North Carolinians are not happy about the legislature making it easier for, you know, gay and lesbian friends, neighbors, family members to be fired from their job or denied service at a restaurant simply because they're gay. And this is a huge intrusion into people's privacy to sort of have the government play the role of bathroom cop, where we're going to tell people where to use the restroom, transgender individuals where to use the restroom, slot them into a restroom that is less appropriate, all in response to a problem that did not exist. So there's been, you know, a lot of public outcry related to this. The business community has spoken out with near uniformity in opposition to HB2. You spoke of the Attorney General refusing to defend this act, finding that it's very clearly unconstitutional, and also that it potentially had an impact on his non-discrimination provisions that he has to protect his employees at, in the Attorney General's office. You know, the legislature has actually not revised HB2 in any way, shape, or form. The governor, Pat McCrory, issued a few weeks after HB2 was adopted an executive order that really did not change much of anything. It doubled down on the bathroom provisions that are discriminatory in HB2. It did indicate that North Carolina was committed to protecting their state employees from discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. It's, you know, first unclear whether the governor had the authority to do such a thing without the legislature endorsing that. Further, it is unclear how that commitment would be borne out. There's no mechanism. So if you feel like you're a state employee and you have been discriminated against because you're gay, there's no mechanism identified to enforce that right. And finally, the governor has repeatedly refused to recognize that requiring, you know, a transgender woman to use the men's room, because that is what is on her birth certificate, is discriminatory and discriminates against transgender individuals. So this could be something that looks one way on paper, but in practice actually does not offer any real protections to the LGBT community in the state employee workforce.
It also seems to me that we're forgetting half of the transgender population in all the discussions of this, which would be transgender men.
Yes, that's been a remarkable aspect of the conversation is, you know, this deeply offensive focus on quote unquote men in women's rooms. So basically referring to transgender women and refusing to acknowledge that they are women first, but then second, you know, arguing that a transgender woman is somehow a pervert or someone who is going to do something untoward in the restroom and is going to utilize this as a way into the restroom to, you know, sort of surveil women in the restroom.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. In this segment, Jen Wilson and Peggy Knutson are speaking with Chris Brook of the ACLU of North Carolina about HB2.
You know, there are 18 states and over 200 municipalities that have such protections, and they've had no such problems with either privacy or public safety. But yeah, again, this is sort of that there's no conversation about transgender men in men's room. You know, the folks have not trotted out what would be an equally offensive misframing of this, which would be women in men's rooms. It's very much sort of a lot of men talking about standing up and protecting women in restrooms. You know, I think that, as previously stated, fundamentally misunderstands and misapprehends what is at stake here and serves to sort of erase or fail to acknowledge there is a transgender community. I think also it, like many civil rights discussions in the past, centers around the notion of quote unquote protecting women from some other group that's going to do something untoward and sort of utilizing that fear to move public opinion in the absence of any data to bear out that fear.
It seems that also missing from the conversation are subgroups of the transgender community that are even more vulnerable, including kids in schools, as well as transgender folks who are incarcerated or detained.
Well, you know, I think that's absolutely right. One of the most galling aspects of the conversation that's been occurring here is with the Department of Justice bringing a lawsuit subsequent to our lawsuit that we brought on behalf of six North Carolinians. The governor and the legislature have talked a lot about federal overreach and the federal government bullying them, when in reality, it has been the governor and the legislative leaders who have been bullying the transgender community. And listen, there are 38,000 transgender individuals, best estimate, in North Carolina, a lot of which are youth, who are very much following this conversation and are being presented in a decidedly negative fashion, or being called, quote unquote, you know, men in women's dresses. And that sort of erasure and otherizing of the community is going to have an impact. My friend James Miller, who works at the LGBT Center of Raleigh, has talked about how there, since the passage of HB2, they've had a huge uptick in members of the transgender community calling in distress, considering self-harm. And there is not an appreciation that the folks who are in danger in these circumstances are not cisgendered individuals, but transgender individuals who are frequently singled out for discrimination and harassment, and in particular in this bathroom context. And, you know, you see that borne out in the statistics, but you also see that, as you referenced, sort of in the overrepresentation of the transgender community in the prisoner population in the state of North Carolina and really nationwide.
So, Chris, can you talk anything about the suits happening now against the state, or McCrory rather, and what kind of path that lawsuit is going to take? I know that state has also sued the federal government. The federal government has sued North Carolina. Is this going to be a 14th Amendment case?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are actually now 5 lawsuits relating to HB2 that are currently pending in North Carolina. We filed the first lawsuit, and we represent 6 North Carolinians, LGBT North Carolinians, who are impacted and harmed by HB2. We filed that lawsuit a little bit less than 5 days after HB2 became law. We filed it on March 28th. And just recently, on May the 16th, we filed for a preliminary injunction seeking to block the provisions of HB2, the bathroom provisions, from remaining in effect. In the meantime, as you referenced, there were 4 other lawsuits filed. The governor and the legislative leaders sued the Department of Justice on May 9th, challenging the federal government's interpretation of what constituted sex discrimination pursuant to Title IX, Title VII, and the Violence Against Women Act. As well, Alliance Defending Freedom, conservative religious group, filed suit on behalf of a group called North Carolinians for Privacy, which is a new group that's unincorporated. It's not entirely clear who their members are, but they filed suit along similar grounds as well. So there are a number of different claims that are being brought. Everyone, I think all of the lawsuits reference, and perhaps Governor McCrory's does not, but the vast majority of the lawsuits reference Title IX, which prohibits sex discrimination at entities that receive federal educational funds. And the question there is whether sex discrimination is inclusive of discrimination based on gender identity. The 4th Circuit Court of Appeals recently concluded that that was the case in a case surrounding bathroom access in a high school student out of Virginia. Then there are Title VII claims, which are in the employment context. And again, it's Title VII prohibits sex discrimination in employment. And then the United States Department of Justice brought challenges based on the fact that our state Department of Public Safety receives grant funding through the Violence Against Women Act, and it contains prohibitions on discrimination based on gender identity in its terms. So all of those claims are being brought in the lawsuits that feature the Department of Justice in some way, shape, or form. Our lawsuit features Title IX component, but also makes arguments based on the 14th Amendment and its guarantee of equal protection and due process under the law, and it's also guarantee of individual dignitary and privacy interests. You know, we're arguing that this constitutes discrimination based on sex, as well as discrimination based on transgender status, both of which should receive heightened review, which would mean that the government needs to come forward with a very persuasive rationale for the measures that they've enacted and prove that the measure that they've enacted is not far too broad for those purposes. I think that in this instance, there's no problem whatsoever with transgender individuals utilizing the restrooms that accords with their gender identity. The government will have trouble bringing forward that sort of evidence. And in addition, the restrictions that they've put in place aren't narrowly tailored to the stated interests that they have anyway.
What do you recommend that citizens do to be aware of this stuff as it spreads throughout the country? And I suspect that it will. We all already have news of I-1515 in Washington. What can citizens do to be prepared?
Well, I think the first thing is getting educated on these issues and making sure that you know the facts and, you know, speak to members of the LGBT community about how this is going to impact them. That always, I always learn something in the course of those conversations. You know, I think familiarizing yourself with the experiences that the 18 states and over 200 municipalities that have such protections for the entire LGBT community have had is always a good idea, because I think it highlights that this is really very much sort of a best business practice for communities in the 21st century as a way to signal that they're a welcoming and inclusive community that should be able to attract and retain the best talent to their community, but also to indicate that, you know, a lot of this mythology surrounding bathroom access is just that. It's mythology. Law enforcement does not have any problems with these local non-discrimination ordinances, that they are actually something that help foster better relationships between the community and the law enforcement community. And that's something that we very much leaned in with the recent preliminary injunction motion that we filed. But also, you know, get to know a little bit more about the science of gender and transgender status and transgender individuals. Up on our website right now, www.acluofnc.org, we have all of the declarations that we submitted in support of our preliminary injunction status, preliminary injunction request, and those include declarations from experts on gender identity about how gender dysphoria and the feeling that the gender that you were assigned at birth does not comport with your gender identity is very real and something that, if left untreated, can have exceptionally harsh consequences for transgender individuals. You know, it helps to get informed about the consequences of not having bathroom access. One of the declarations that we put up there is from somebody who speaks about transgender individuals frequently getting urinary tract infections because they do not have a facility that they feel comfortable using. And that's something that our transgender plaintiffs in the case have spoken to, that prior to HB2, on the university campuses where they worked or studied, they had a restroom that they could use accorded with their gender identity. And now they don't feel like there is a place that is safe for them to use the restroom anymore. So they're either going massively out of their way to use a single-use facility, or they're trying to not use the restroom during the course of their workday or their school day. And that's something that can come with medical consequences. And also, just from a moral ethical point, how comfortable do we feel making our fellow human beings worry about where they're going to use the restroom? I don't think any of us should feel comfortable with that.
Those are wonderful points. I've talked to many people in my community, and they don't want to believe that this is a real issue just because it's not so close to them. I mean, we're not in North Carolina, obviously. And I've heard concerns that this is being overhyped by the media. I'm not sure that people really understand, you know, what danger this presents for our fellow beings and our communities.
Yeah. Well, a huge percentage of the transgender community, over 50%, has faced discrimination in the workplace or has faced discrimination in utilizing public accommodations. And HB2 took away their ability to protect not only transgender community, but also the lesbian, gay, and bisexual community from discrimination at the workplace or from discrimination in public accommodations. So that is an exceptionally real consequence. We represent a gay couple that sought fertility services in Charlotte and were turned away because they were a same-sex couple. If the local non-discrimination ordinance had been in place, they would have had a way to seek redress. But now with HB2 on the books, they don't. So these are very real consequences. But also, you know, in the bathroom context, the Williams Institute produced a report that said that 9% of transgender individuals have faced violence in the bathroom context and faced violence in other contexts as well. This is something where we really need to weigh the consequences on the transgender community from not extending these protections to them. But in addition, we need to weigh the consequences of our leaders standing up and endorsing discrimination and demonizing an entire community. When you model that sort of bullying behavior, bullies are going to take notice, and the transgender community, already marginalized, is going to pay a price for that.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that the RFRA Act that was passed in Indiana last year, the economic effects that that was going to have really had a part to play in that RFRA law being changed. But it doesn't seem to have had the same effect in North Carolina. There have been economic boycotts, but in North Carolina, it doesn't seem to have worked. Do you have an explanation?
I'm not sure that I have a foolproof explanation. You know, it's been an economic bloodbath here since HB2 was passed. PayPal announced that they were rescinding a previous 400 job expansion that they had planned for North Carolina. Deutsche Bank put on hold 250 jobs that they were going to be bringing online in the Triangle in North Carolina. Google Ventures indicated that they would not be moving forward with further business efforts in North Carolina while HB2 remained on the books. You know, you've had companies from Food Lion to Lowe's to Wells Fargo to the NBA talk about how that's needed to be repealed. The NBA has talked about removing the All-Star game from Charlotte, where it's supposed to be next year. In addition to that, you've had more than 20 conventions that were going to be in North Carolina move out of state. La Raza, Latino Advocacy Group, was the most recent convention that I'm aware of that moved out of North Carolina. You've had a series of performers indicate that they were not going to perform in North Carolina while HB2 was on the books. Just today, Maroon 5 canceled their Raleigh and Charlotte shows pursuant to HB2. Most famously, Bruce Springsteen announced that he would not perform in Greensboro due to HB2. The same with Ringo Starr and Pearl Jam. So there have been dire economic consequences, and that's not even talking about the federal funds that we're putting at risk by having this measure that conflicts with Title IX and Title VII on the books. The governor of Indiana and the legislature in Indiana showed a lot more flexibility and a lot more willingness to hear the business community. Unfortunately, we've not seen that in North Carolina. Just this week, there was a company that is a pharmaceuticals company that indicated that they were considering not bringing 50 jobs to Durham based on HB2, and ultimately they decided they would, but that they very much believed HB2 needed to be repealed and that they planned to fight HB2 from within North Carolina. And after saying that, the governor attacked the pharmaceutical company and similarly has attacked PayPal and Bruce Springsteen and Pearl Jam for not performing here. It's been a very perplexing performance from our leaders statewide, who are generally bend over backwards to accommodate any business request. And in this instance, the business community has spoken with near unanimity and exceptionally clearly. And instead of finding a way to accommodate business requests, they've attacked businesses.
You indicated there was sort of a precedent set with a case in Virginia, a transgender student, and the Fourth Circuit Court ruled that that student could use the restroom that accorded with their gender identity. So there is a bit of precedent that has been set. Do you foresee that this just going to go circuit court by circuit court? And there have been many laws proposed and passed since the North Carolina law. Is this something that may eventually go all the way to the Supreme Court?
That's certainly possible. That we've obviously seen some copycat legislation since HB2 was enacted. The remarkable thing has been that a lot of states have walked away from measures along these lines after HB2. For example, South Carolina, which has traditionally been the more conservative Carolina, there was a bathroom bill that was introduced there that was actually far narrower than HB2, so it didn't have the employment and public accommodations impact. And the South Carolina governor said, well, we don't need to do this, and that proposal died. You know, I have no doubt that there was a big hubbub about the Obama administration's guidance in regards to accommodating transgender students. Last week, a lot of rhetoric in regards to that. We'll see if there's, you know, if that's all smoke or there's a little bit of fire there. But you know, North Carolina really stands alone in adopting such a draconian, across-the-board attack on the LGBT community. I think, you know, the case involving Gavin Grimm, the transgender student in Virginia, the Fourth Circuit panel of three judges sided with Gavin about bathroom usage. I believe that they're seeking en banc, which is a review by the entire 15-judge panel. I believe that that decision will be upheld. And then, you know, I think there'll be an appeal to the Supreme Court. I don't know whether an 8-judge Supreme Court would be interested in reviewing this measure at this point.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Stephanie Zvan. In this segment, Jen Wilson and Peggy Knutson are speaking with Chris Brook of the ACLU of North Carolina about HB2, and Peggy and I will talk with Danielle White, a transgender activist in North Carolina.
So, you know, it's certainly possible that it could go to the Supreme Court at some point. I mean, the fact of the matter is that no other state has chosen to follow the North Carolina model because I think they've seen that there are real consequences for doing that. But in addition, you know, and that you get a reputation as a state that's not welcoming and not inclusive, which is very unfortunate. I think in addition, at bottom, folks on the other side understand that these measures are not necessary and that taking away protections for the LGBT community in the public accommodations and employment context is simply out of step with where the nation is at in 2015.
I don't think I'm alone in hoping that this bill is struck down swiftly. Any wisdom you can offer in terms of how long this might take?
Well, you know, the answer always in law school is it depends. But, you know, and that's a little bit the case here as well. But the reality is we filed for a preliminary injunction on May 16th. Those defending HB2 have through June 9th to respond. This matter could be fully briefed before the district court judge in June or July, could be in court in front of that judge if he wished to hold hearings sometime over the course of the summer. So, you know, I think that it's something where we could get a ruling, the first ruling later this year. But, you know, these things do take some time. And that's why it's so important that you're doing what you're doing with your show, because we need to, while the litigation is moving forward, also be continuing to do public education.
We appreciate what you're doing.
Well, I appreciate what y'all are doing too. It's so important that we have these discussions and really have a thoughtful, deliberative process, which was unfortunately sorely lacking here in North Carolina.
Indeed.
Chris, tell us where people can find out more information about you and about the case.
The best way is just to go to our website, which is ACLUOFNC.org, where we have really frequent updates. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Brook, CHRISBROOK ACLU. You can follow us on Twitter, ACLU of North Carolina as well on Twitter. And we're working with Lambda Legal as well. So, you know, I think if you follow our organizations, you're going to get a very good feeling for where the case is at and also get access to some really good material to understand what's happening.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Chris. We really appreciate you joining us today. And we wish you so much luck on the case.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Welcome to the show, Danielle White. Danielle is a transgender woman living in North Carolina. She is an activist who has been pushing back and engaging in civil disobedience against HB2 since it passed. Welcome to the show, Danielle.
Thank you for having me.
And we also have Peggy with us for this segment of the show.
Hi.
Danielle, let's start by asking, what part of North Carolina are you in? Because I know a lot of people outside the Carolinas tend to think of North Carolina as the South, but obviously things differ a bit depending on what part of the state you're in.
You're quite right about that, and it is an oversimplification to consider it simply the South as such. I'm in the Research Triangle area, which is Raleigh-Durham, Chapel Hill. It's often been referred to as a blue dot in a red state, and to the point that the infamous Jesse Helms once suggested years ago when the state was debating where to place the state zoo, he suggested they should put a fence around Chapel Hill and call it the state zoo. That's how much it is a very blue, liberal, progressive area.
So this is the area with the universities and the tech companies and that sort of thing. So it's not what you see in most of the rest of the state.
That is correct. There are major technical and biotechnical lawyers here, a number of universities, big ones being NC State, UNC Chapel Hill, and Duke University, of course.
As a transgender woman, how was this atmosphere for living in before HB2 passed?
If you won't mind, I'm going to modify the statement. I am a transgender woman, but I'm also lesbian and in a relationship with another woman. So that impacts my experience here as well. In this area, it largely was a non-issue for me. I transitioned while living here. The best way I can put it is it's the kind of area where my wife and I can walk down the street holding hands in where we live, the city of Durham, or go to dinner and just be a couple, an obvious couple, and it's a non-issue to people.
And has that changed since HB2?
Locally, I haven't noticed a change in that. Again, though, I'm in an area where generally people and places, businesses, are open about their opposition to HB2.
Is this your first venture into activism, or is this something that, because of HB2, or is it something you were involved in prior to the bill?
There's a little from column A and a little from column B for that for me. I've been involved in some activism to certain degrees, but nothing nearly so prominent as this before HB2 happened.
Tell us what you're doing.
Well, I think the most prominent thing I have done is to be very forward in undertaking civil disobedience of it, publicly documenting that I have violated the law by using the women's restroom at state government-owned buildings and openly daring the state to arrest me for violating it. I'm willing to be that test case for it.
Have you received any response, positive or negative?
I was interviewed by a local ABC affiliate television station, and generally I've received some positive responses, particularly among the local trans community.
How do you think the religious right is using fear to achieve their goals? Do you think they're successful?
They've enjoyed a measure of success, clearly, but I think it's been tempered a bit, honestly. They've clearly been using it in certain ways to include a little bit of a story. I have a friend who, she is a transgender woman. She works in tech, but not in the Research Triangle area and not in one of the other major urban areas of the state. And she has directly from coworkers come face to face with how that fear has done things like, in their mind, conflate being transgender to being a pedophile.
I've seen that on many of the talk shows and the news programs that people are saying, well, this is just going to be used by predators to get into the bathrooms, which it seems quite laughable to me. It's not like they couldn't do that anyway.
Oh, you're quite right about that. But the additional aspect that I'm seeing is, even though they are saying, oh, it's not about trans people, what's actually happening for a lot of people is the two are being conflated, that someone who is trans is a predator.
How does that make you feel? It seems very frustrating when those things are being conflated.
It's a scary concept, to be honest, to deal with and live knowing that there are people out there who, in no small part because of this, now see me in such a way. And honestly, there are people out there open that they would happily harm me or kill me because of it.
Yeah. You've mentioned that you are part of a larger trans community in the Research Triangle area. What are you hearing from other trans people in the region?
There's a lot of fear. They're worried. I have a friend who wound up having to leave her studies at one of the state universities because the risk was too great. She has a family to take care of and just cannot justify taking that risk. There are others who are a bit more like me. They're willing to fight it in that way. They're willing to risk being jailed as part of fighting it. I think it has brought the community a bit closer together in a lot of ways, that we are fighting something like this as a community.
Are you seeing more organizing, political organizing happening?
I'm seeing a fair bit. It's different, though. It's in a somewhat different way than had existed, because previously there was organizing happening. It was more about working with, say, the local healthcare systems to improve the options for care and things such as that.
How do you think we can help people to understand and clarify what it means to be transgender?
There's the proverbial $64,000 question. If I may make a reference, that probably dates myself. I think there's multiple facets to it. One is for people who are cisgender to have these discussions with other people. I have several friends, mostly through Facebook, where I happen to see it, simply because it's easy for me to just happen upon it there, who have been very direct about that. Even though these laws don't directly affect them, they're having those conversations, they're engaging and not being willing to let people just go away with, oh, it's a difference of opinions, it doesn't affect anyone here, so forth. They accept, hey, it affects my friends, it affects people I care about, and I'm going to make that issue, I'm going to make the stand as well. I think there's a large amount of an education aspect to it.
I also see that in the gay and lesbian community, things began to change when people started to realize that they knew people who were gay or lesbian, and they had people in their families, friends. Those people were very open. There's probably a lot fewer in the transgender community, so this might take a lot longer. Might be a more difficult and uphill battle.
That's also part of why I am so very much out as a transgender woman who also is lesbian, both aspects combining. There's been a history, too, of the LGBT organizations, both at state and national levels, not doing very well regarding transgender representation and transgender rights. And there's activism happening on that as well.
Now, is that activism from the community trying to make those organizations move, or are you seeing organizations step up to the challenge of the law?
Definitely the former, of transgender people undertaking the activism to push those organizations to move. And I'm trying to be fair to the organizations. I see things that indicate they might be. I have to confess at this moment, though, my perception is definitely colored by many years of history where they were not. I may have a, shall we call it, somewhat jaded view of them. In fairness, though, it would probably be appropriate to say they are beginning to make that effort.
What do you think the humanist community as a whole can do to support you in your activism?
To some degrees, I think it's similar to what I see so many of my friends doing is, you know, this is an issue that just affects people as a whole. In particular, it's an issue where religious right aspects are coming into it. And I strongly feel this is the battlefront now because they have lost on other issues. They're trying to regain ground. They're trying to prevent, well, frankly, us from winning on this, on the entire matter. It's a much greater issue than just transgender rights and the right to use, taking North Carolina as an example with the specific clause of HB 2, the right to use the gender-appropriate restrooms in government buildings.
When we talk about the fact that this is all centering around bathrooms, in some ways that feels trivial, but you mentioned your friend who was a student at a state university. If you can't go to the bathroom, you can't go to school. If you work at one of these institutions, you can't go to work.
It honestly does tend to have that effect. And I will note, I used to work for a state university. That's where I worked when I transitioned. So it would have had that impact on me as well.
I'm seeing copycat laws popping up all around the country. I don't know if you're following any of those.
I have been hearing about some of those. I have a friend who lives in Tulsa, Oklahoma, for example, who has been lobbying heavily against an attempt at it in Oklahoma. There's also an attempt at a ballot measure to repeal a protection for transgender people that the state of Washington has had in place for 10 years now.
You just came back from vacation. Did you have to pay attention to where you were going and what the state legislatures were doing as you planned your trip?
I can't say I'd let it go quite to that level, but then again, I tend to take the view of, what's the worst they can do, arrest me? Fine, bring it. That's a little bit of an... Yes, you understand. I tend to be of the, okay, we'll fight this. But not everyone has the position of a privilege that I do in my life to be able to say that and be able to take that. I will say, though, I think the bigger wages of this particular push is that it has fanned a lot of individual animosity out there. And as a result, I had to think, I always thought a lot when I would stop to visit friends, we'd visit at a restaurant or something like that. Or I would just stop in a particular restaurant along my way. I would always think, is this a place that is reasonably safe for me? I definitely feel that has changed, that there's far less that is truly safe, and directly because of this particular push.
It's really interesting that you are talking about safety, because it seems as if that's what the proponents of the laws claim they want.
You're quite right there. They very directly and intentionally chosen a strategy to other a group and use safety as an argument. And if we think back, what is it, perhaps about 10 years, safety as an argument in for a political matter was very successfully used at a pretty much national level.
Is there anything else that you particularly want people to come away from this interview with?
I think the first thing is, you know, people like me are your next door neighbors. We're working. I work for a high-tech job in the area and have, as part of it, I have clearances to work on a whole bunch of very interesting systems, the nature of what I do. Now, these are people who are in parts of your everyday life. I would also like to add a question that needs to be more handled. It has to do with people who, they are transgender. Their identity isn't simply male or female. I'm not speaking to that, though, because that isn't me. So I don't want to try to speak for them. Also, I think for myself, I want to make it clear, you're talking to someone who has an incredible level of security in her own life, educated in a field where I could leave my job tomorrow and I know I can land something else. A lot of the people who are adversely affected by this are struggling with un- and underemployment, very direct discrimination. I have several friends who have been, I have one who just, and thanks to some of the other provisions of HB 2, this person just was denied housing because they are trans. And one of the lesser known provisions of HB 2 is that he cannot seek a remedy for that in the state courts. He would have to go to the federal courts now. And so I realize it's a little bit of a rambling response, but also understand that these laws are being used to include a lot of things that affect far more than just transgender people.
All right. Thank you very much, Danielle. We really appreciate you taking a little time out and talking to us. I appreciate you being forthright and frankly a little raw. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome. If I may add on that, when you say a little raw, that is one reason why I say I'm not the person you need in the committee meetings when it comes to the finer points. I'm the proverbial 2x4 between the eyes. But it does take all of that.
Well, we appreciate you and the work you're doing, putting yourself out there.
Thank you.
As always, we value your feedback on the show. Have a comment or question for today's guests? Have a suggestion for a guest you'd like us to interview? Email us at humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Thank you again for listening to The Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association.